Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burge and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. No set schedule, just whenever I get round to reading a book, I review it and stick the review up here in the podcast feed. So yeah, it's only been a few days since I've did the last podcast, since I last reviewed a book. I think it was only like 2 days ago. I already actually finished the book I'm going to review today by that time, so that's why it's not taken me long to read it. Not much feedback actually since the last episode, really, because it's only been a few days, I guess, and not many people have emailed. A few people emailed back about the book that I've written. Well, it's not a book, it's like a novella, which isn't even a book as yet, probably might never ever be a book, but it's been good feedback actually, so I'm going to really enjoy releasing this book, this novella, to the world, to the wider world, maybe in a few months' time after a few different edits. My brother just read it and he said it was much better than he expected, which is very nice of him because I know he's a big science fiction fan and I know his tastes as well, which is pretty good. So yeah, in a few months' time I'll be putting that out. One person though did ask, let me see if I can find the email, Dave, he asks, what is the music that you use at the start of your podcast? And the music is actually something I wrote myself, and it's called 1:45 a.m. and Still Alone. And I probably wrote and recorded it over 10 years ago now, back before my university days. And I studied creative music technology at university, so I must have been probably around about 17 or 18 when I recorded that. Probably 18 when I recorded that, so yeah. About 10 years ago now. I have a long history of making music, and that was sort of like this electronic kind of style. I thought it was suitably science fictionist and quite uplifting to use as a theme tune, so there you go. I don't actually have it to download anywhere, but maybe I'll find it. I don't have it on this computer. I'll have it on an old computer somewhere backed up, so I might put it up online and link to it at some point. So anyway, nothing else to say feedback-wise, but if you want to send in feedback or any stories or any book recommendations, do so, luke@juggler.net. That's the best way to get hold of me. So straight on to today's book review, and I'm going to be reviewing Ian M. Banks, his latest culture novel called Matter. And it was only published last year, in 2008, and I actually wanted to buy it as soon as it came out, but I couldn't really justify spending, I think it was like €28 when it came out here in Germany, so I thought, well, I'll just wait for the price to go down a bit. And last time I passed through Heathrow Airport a few weeks ago, I picked it up, and it was only £5, so it was worth just waiting a few months. So, you know, I can wait for a few months, even though if it is one of my favourite science fiction authors to put a book out, I'll certainly buy it new, but maybe not in hardcover. And the story comes in at around about 550 to about 600 pages. I'm not exactly sure, because when you pick up the book, you think, oh, that's really thick, but it doesn't actually go all the way up to the end. There's just sort of like these grey pages at the end of the book, and when you flick to them, it says extras, and in it you get an interview with the author, and then you get the first few chapters of the book Consider Phlebas, or Phlebas, not quite sure how to pronounce that, which was, it says, also by Ian Banks, not Ian M. Banks. I got his name wrong here in the back of the book. But that's his very first culture novel, I think, or his very first science fiction novel, culture novel. There it is. So, but then, if you're looking, like, going from the back of the book towards the front, then you get the epilogue, and then in front of the epilogue you get an appendix, like a glossary, and then you get to actually the novel, the main chunk of the novel itself. So even though it's actually, the book probably comes in at around about, I'd say, maybe, you know, 650, well, it's a bit chunky, it looks a lot chunkier than it actually is, let me put it that way. So, I said this is a culture novel, and if you don't know anything about Ian M. Banks and his science fiction, the culture is this sort of universe, this society that he's written about many, many times. I don't really want to spend too much time here at the beginning of this review going into it, but just simply put, it's like this pan-human society. I say pan-human, so it's not just Homo sapiens that have evolved on Earth. It's sort of like human-type creatures that have evolved or spread out across big parts of the galaxy, sort of come together in this very super advanced society, and they it's all sort of what they call a post-scarcity society. So it means there's no money, everything just runs with like nanotechnology and advanced biological kind of manipulation, and anything that you need can be manufactured for you. As long as there's enough energy and matter out there, you can make it, no problem at all. The thing is, humans don't don't do any of the work. It's all up to robots and ships. The ships are the main, and the ships' minds are the main things running the place. They're sort of super advanced artificial intelligence, and they do all the grunt work. But they do have like distinct personalities of their own. And then you get like the smaller robots called the drones, which are sort of like human, sort of more advanced than humans intellectually, but more of a human level rather than the super advancedness of the ships' minds. And of course, you've got the humans as well, and they can change their bodies and do all kinds of things with their bodies because they just by thinking about it, they can change their physical kind of appearances and all that kind of stuff. They can change sex from male to female and back again, no problem at all. Everyone lives on the ships or in orbitals, which are these big, you know, sort of things that spin and are absolutely massive. They spin once every 24 hours ish, and you stand on the inside of them going around, and that's what sticks you to the inside of the orbital. Just by the putting it next to a star and it's spinning, you get day and night cycle once every 24 hours. And there's lots of other things, but not many people live on planets because there seem to be a bit of a waste of matter, because for each bit of Earth or each bit of matter, you can only stand around the very edge of it. And they like to be on ships where you can have layers and layers and layers and layers and layers of population, or on the orbitals, which is a thin layer that goes a long way. So that's the kind of thing that you're in there. So that's called the Culture, and the Culture's got this special department called Contact, and Contact's job is to go out and contact other species and other human-style species and bring them into, or maybe not bring them into the Culture, but sort of make sure they develop towards, you know, a more enlightened society. So that's what Contact does. Special Circumstances is a unit of Contact which deals with special circumstances, and they're sort of more of like a military kind of wing and more espionage kind of wing. So they're the kind of people who are used by Contact and used by the ship's minds to sort out situations where a slightly heavier hand is needed, or maybe a slightly more subtle hand is needed, but an unseen subtle hand. And that's what Special Circumstances' job is. So Ian M. Banks has written many Culture novels, and let me just flick to the inside cover of the book here, because they're all mentioned here, because each one of them deals with like a different aspect of the Culture. So the first one that he wrote, what's called Consider Phlebas, that really like talks about some specific war and that like the past history of the Culture, and since then all the other books are set further in, like further along the timeline. Also you have Player of Games, which sort of talks about like the Culture, kind of the way that the Culture set up a bit more, you know, in later on in its timeline. But also it talks a bit more about like a non-contact person being manipulated and being used by the Special Circumstances unit and what they get up to. Next you had Use of Weapons, which I've already reviewed, and that talks very much about a non-culture person, not just a non-contact person, but a non-culture person being used by the Special Circumstances. Then you have State of the Art, which is like, I think it was more of a collection of short stories, but they had like a novella in that one, and that was very much about Earth's place in the Culture, because even though everyone there seems to be sort of human-like, they're not actually properly human, and Earth isn't a part of the Culture, which is quite interesting. Then you got Against a Dark Background, which isn't a Culture novel. Fearsome Engine, which isn't a Culture novel. You've got Accession, and that talks much more about the ships and the ships' minds. You know, there are humans involved and other like things like that, but not so much. Then you have Inversions, which is very interesting, because even though it's a Culture novel, the word Culture, I don't think is ever actually mentioned in the book. It talks about the Culture and the Culture's influence on a planet, but from the planet's point of view, not from the Culture's point of view, which is pretty cool. Then you got Look to Windward, which again, it's sort of set on an orbital. Most of it's set on an orbital, so you get a lot more orbital kind of stuff, but also that one of the main characters is an alien who isn't really part of the Culture, or is sort of. Then you get The Algebraist, not a Culture novel, and then you got the Matter novel, which I'm reviewing now, or going to review right now, and this novel concentrates very much on the Culture influence outside of Culture space. Everything, all these other books, takes place inside of the culture sphere of influence, whereas this book takes place outside of the culture sphere of influence, and you know, you sort of see a lot more of the wider galactic community and sort of how that is set up. So you're involving like lots more different races than you would do normally, or in some ways, but also the things that happen, it's sort of like it takes a long time to get from culture space across to this other place as well. So yeah, it's like a real like a travel kind of book throughout culture space and then the wider universe outside of culture space. And one of the main key things that you find out about is the roles that races have compared to others. So for example, you have like the basic level of uninvolved, completely uninvolved species, which is the what do they call the Sahl. And the Sahl are just this sort of backwards kind of place, and they live somewhere. But at one point, the Sahl meets the Okt, and the Okt are the species that are looking after the Sahl. And they go, oh, wow, it's amazing. They're just so far ahead of us. And then what happens is that they meet the Narasine, and the Narasine is the species that are looking after the Okt. And they're like, wow, they're just as far above us again. And then they meet the Mordenvelt, and the Mordenvelt are just as far above the Narasine as the Okt, as the Narasine are above the Okt, and the Okt are above the Sahl. And so, and the Mordenvelt are about comparable to the culture kind of level. So you get this layer and layer of different species and different societies. And the idea is that when you get a low-level society, they can't immediately like be contacted by the Mordenvelt, because they'd just be completely blown away. And so then, but not the Narasine, they're too far above them as well. The Okt are about the right level, so they can meet the Okt and they won't be completely culture shocked. And this is one of the main themes in the book, which I actually really quite enjoyed this idea. It's a little bit like it reminded me very much of the Uplift Wars, the Uplift War book and the other sort of Uplift kind of universe by David Brin, because there it's sort of the same kind of thing, layers and layers of different alien species, very advanced ones at the top, and then they go down and down. Although the culture is a bit more about sort of like letting the species develop naturally and sort of like just protecting them from the outside world, whereas the Uplift kind of universe or galaxy, it's a bit more proactive. The races actually go out and sort of get as many other species as they can and sort of like intelligence, you know, make them into intelligent spacefaring kind of species. So that's the kind of setup that we're dealing with here, unique to like the unique look at the culture universe. I can't just call it the culture because it's actually outside of the culture. So that's pretty cool. Next we have that's the setup. But of course, the novel itself takes place on this, most of it takes place revolving around a very unique setting. It's like a big dumb object kind of thing that we've got here, and they call it a shell world. And what you have is like a sphere with a smaller sphere inside of it, and a smaller sphere inside of it, and a smaller sphere inside of it, and a smaller sphere inside of it, like layers and layers and layers of different size shells. And each one of the layers is separated by these columns and pillars, and they've each got a unique atmosphere in them and a unique kind of the gravity is just, you know, the same throughout this whole sphere, or you know, it increases of course as you go to the outside, but the but at the different levels you get different species living there. And the reason it was built, nobody's really quite sure exactly what the reasons were, but it was like millions upon millions upon millions of years ago, or a billion of years ago, I can't remember exactly how many eons it was beforehand, but apparently they were built and they were going to be filled with liquids, and the liquids would rush around the inside, and there was thousands of them all the way around the outside of the galaxy, all the way through the galaxy, and they would create some kind of force field around the whole galaxy. So we're talking big engineering project here, things that never actually worked out, and the alien race that put them in place seemed to have disappeared before they used them. So what's happened is other alien races have come into them and sort of like put in the atmospheres, and so that's why people can live in them now, or different species can live in these shell worlds. So it's actually quite an interesting big a big kind of project there. And now of course in the past some of them were destroyed by this alien race who just set out to destroy them. Nobody was actually quite sure why, and some of them have got gods inside of them, which are not really gods. It's a big race of some kind of floating cloud kind of, I'm not actually quite sure what kind of alien they were, but it's a big, very, very powerful alien which has sort of dropped out of the galactic society and is sort of now just retired to the inside of some of these shell worlds. They're called the Xynthian, I think. So our story takes place on one of these shell worlds. There's only a few hundred left, or a few thousand left, not many of these left at all. And there's the shell world which this is concerns with is a place called Sursamon, and particularly the 8th and 9th levels down into Sursamon, or up from, no, I think down into the depths of Sursamon. And there's this basically human race called the Sahl, and they have a technical level of around about sort of just coming out of medieval, just coming into some kind of industrial kind of setup there. They've got gunpowder, and, you know, they have fights, a bit kind of like Napoleonic War kind of battles can take place. And the Sahl are actually in a war right at the beginning of the book with another species of the same race, very like typically human race, from the level one below, down on level number 9, and they're called the Deldin. And this is how the book opens, with a battle between the Deldin and the Sahl, because the Deldin have played a trick, or tricked the Sahl, and they've come up one of these columns, one of these pillars in between the two levels, and popped out right next to the capital city of the Sahl. But the thing is, the Sahl know it was going to happen, because they were told by the Oct, by their alien species just above them in that sort of social hierarchy, and so that the Sahl win the war. So that's what's happening. That's the setup that's happening right there at the beginning of the book. The story itself follows different members of one royal family and a few other characters, but mainly these characters. We've got the king, and the king actually dies in the opening chapter, or second chapter, or third chapter in the book. Not giving anything away there, really. That'll spoil it. So his reign has to pass on to one of his sons, or one of his children. But of course, his oldest son has already died before the book started. But he was going to be, you know, he was very much like the king. He would have taken over with no problem at all. The next youngest child of the king, or offspring of the king, is a daughter called Dian Anaplian. Again, I'm not quite sure I got that right. I think it's Anaplian. There's actually, I said that before, there's a glossary in the back of this book, some kind of appendix, and it's really handy for this. Yes, Anaplian. She was really hated by her father for not being male and for killing her mother in childbirth. So she's actually taken away by the culture, and in some kind of bizarre exchange scheme, and just when she was very young. And now she is a special circumstances agent, out of contact with her family, and is working elsewhere in the galaxy. But so she's not around to take the place of the king. The next son, the next offspring, is a son called Ferbin, and he's not a soldier at all. He considered himself more of a politician, but that's only his own view. He's pretty much a coward and doesn't want to get involved in anything at all. He is thought to have died in the opening battle, but instead he actually saw that his father was killed in a certain way which he doesn't like, and he's actually very, very scared that the same thing might happen to him. He realizes that if he's going to stick around, people think he's dead, but he think if I'm going to stick around, he's also going to be killed by maybe the minions of a guy called Ty Loesp. And Ty Loesp was the second in command to the king and the king's best friend. So he thinks, oh, Ty Loesp is the bad guy here. And he is the bad guy, of course. So he thinks, okay, I'm going to get out of here. Now, so he's not around either. So it comes down to the youngest son. Thing is, the youngest son is not yet 18-year-old. His name is Oromen. And so when his father is and his older brother are declared dead, of course, the daughter isn't involved in this at all. He's not yet old enough to become king. So Ty Loesp, I always say Loesp, just for some reason, that's the way I read it. But saying it now for the first time, it's Loesp. So he becomes the regent, and he's sort of making all the big decisions. The thing is that Oromen doesn't know that Loesp killed his father, so trust him to take care of anything that he wants to. You know, all of Sahl is now being run by Loesp. The thing is, Oromen, you know, doesn't know that in the attempts that are made on his own life to kill him are actually being conducted by the command, or at the command of Loesp himself. So that's the whole setup at the beginning of the book. Of course, you get all that out of the way in the first, you know, 50 pages or so. And we find out that the old king, back in the day, had some contact with the culture years before. And that's what set them off in this war. He sort of, like this guy from the culture, gave them some hints about different types of warfare that they could use. And, of course, that's why the king was very successful. So, of course, Ferbin knows about this guy. And so he sets off with his trusty servant called Hulse. And they set out to find this old culture agent, this special circumstances agent. And so, because Furbin doesn't want to go back and confront Loisp or do anything by himself, so he sets off to find some help from the culture. So this lets us go on a big tour all the way through all these levels that I mentioned earlier, not just the levels of the Shell World, but also the levels of society, and they get to see the scenes behind Morthenfelt-controlled space. Meanwhile, Anaplion, she learns that her father and brother have died, and she decides to head home to see her remaining family and see what needs to go on there as well. So this lets us get another tour, but not of the Morthenfelt space, but also the culture space, as she comes back all the way through and meets the different ships and the different AIs and the interesting characters and sees interesting places all the way back to the Shell World itself. So that's pretty much the setup. Like I said, I just said that before, but I thought I'd add that little bit on. So you may be thinking, okay, what do I care about kings and princes and who takes power? The thing is, you know, because like culture isn't really concerned about that kind of thing, and us now, we're a bit more enlightened than that. We see that, you know, power shouldn't be handed off just from father to son. It's not a very clever way of doing things. Of course, the main point in the book, you know, is to see how really the way that the special circumstances and the culture and also the Morthenfelt are willing to interfere with small powers or not, or help out small powers like in their like inconsequential power struggles or not, because it's just a backwater of the galaxy. Nobody really, well, they care about what's going on there, but it's all about the policy of the more advanced races to the less advanced races. So turns out they're not really willing at all to help anything out there about the kings and princes and who's taking over. But, as you would expect in a big book like this, there's more going on here than just who gets to be king and who gets to be involved in running the Sahl in this little part of a Shell World off in the back corner of the galaxy somewhere. Something mysterious is uncovered within the Sahl realms in an archaeological dig on level 9, and of course that thing has far-reaching consequences. It's all sort of like dum 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 dum, but of course that happens later on, midway through the book. I don't really want to give away any there. So that's the story set up, and that's the way the story goes. Did I like the story? Is it any good? Well, yes and no, really, because yes, I did like all the kind of court intrigue and the assassinations and all the power plays and politics. I liked meeting new aliens, and I liked travelling through culture space, and I liked the big dumb objects, and the Shell World was actually a really fun setting, like the way it's lit up by the rolling stars that roll around the tops of the roofs inside, and all those kind of stuff, and the waterfall. Again, I don't want to give that away, but there's some really good stuff in there. The thing is, each one of those points is sort of solid in some way. For example, the court intrigue and all that kind of stuff, it was interesting, but it didn't really add up to very much. It was quite basic kind of fantasy fare, you know, with sort of like swords and sorcery. Well, not sorcery, but, you know, swords and people going into brothels and all that kind of stuff that you get from like a normal fantasy book, which is all right, but nothing special. But then there's this conflict between Oruman and Loisp, you know, Oruman the young prince who's not yet taken power, and Loisp who's the guy who's trying to like take power. And I quite liked it in a way, because Oruman doesn't realise that Loisp is the actual evil force, controlling force in the world that he is. So, you know, there's this conflict there, but it doesn't actually have any impact on the wider world. If that had been taken out of the book, by the end of the book, yeah, sure, it would have been slightly different, but, you know, there wasn't a whole lot of point to it, plot-wise. And the aliens are also really fun, but except for the idea of the aliens existed, that there are these different levels, they don't, you know, they don't really add anything there either, and because they're not really, you know, they're fun enough, but they seem a bit weak. There's very little character. For example, except for the Oct, they have some kind of like impact and an idea there. But all the other aliens, they seem to just have like one personality, or they're represented by a single alien species. And there's trillions and trillions of them in a single system, but we never meet them. We just meet one of them in the entire book. And again, while they're there, and while we talk about these different levels, again, they don't actually have that much impact on the sort of wider events, or the crucial events that take place in the book, mainly because, or in some ways, because they don't want to get involved at all. And even if they should be getting involved, they don't actually know what's happening. They've been kept in the dark quite a bit. The big dumb object was suitably big, but in a way not suitably done, because I really like the idea of like a sense of wonder, you know, when Rama comes in Arthur C. Clarke's Rama, they come in, it's like, what is it? And there's questions that remain unsolved all the way through. The thing is, right at the beginning of the book, or in the book, we're told that the entire history of the object is known right from the beginning. Of course, like, there's some little bit of mysteries hanging there, but generally, you know, we know what it is, and we know what it was for, and we know what are on all the levels, you know. Maybe the characters that are there don't know, but we're quite quickly told them. So, yeah, there's not a lot of mystery to the Big Dumb Object, except for this one object that's dug up in this archaeological dig. But when that's finally revealed, it was like, yeah, well, that was obvious right from the very beginning of the book what it was going to be. Or not from the very beginning of the book, but as soon as that thing that they dug up was introduced, I'm like, well, I know it has to be this, because there was no other kind of mystery there, so it had to be just this one thing. And what they thought it was, the character thought, it couldn't have been, because it wouldn't be there, you know, it wouldn't actually be buried or anything there, so it could only be one thing, and then it turned out to be that thing, and I was just like, oh, well, there we go. And finally, I mentioned that I enjoy seeing the culture and spending time with the culture, and that's what I actually quite like about the book. It is like one of these, like, it's like a travel book where you sort of go from one place to another and you sort of read about people's experiences there, sort of Bill Bryson style. They go here and meet this interesting person, go there and see that interesting thing. The thing is, it's fun to revisit, but it was nothing new. There's nothing, if you've read other culture books, like three or four other culture books, you're not going to get anything new, you're not going to get any new ideas about the culture by reading this. It's the same old ideas, the same old drones flying around with the witty lines and the same sort of like interesting ship names, you know, except Ian M. Banks has got a new list of ship names. They're probably right here in the glossary at the back, aren't they? They'll probably be here. Ships names. No, I can't see it. I'm sure there is, though. Oh, yeah, there you are. So you've got ships like Don't Try This at Home, or, you know, Experiencing a Significant Gravitas Shortfall, or It's My Party and I'll Sing If I Want To. You know, those are the names of the main spaceships. You'll clean that up before you leave is a gangster class MVFPXROU ship. Which is all quite fun, but it's like, yeah, sure, the funny ship names, they're all good and fun and all that, but why don't you just, you could have just given me this list of ship names and I'd have filled in the blanks, you know, I mean, there's no problem at all. So it seems to be a lot more reflection of the past and past ideas about the culture, so not a lot there to, I mean, it's enjoyable, but there's nothing new to get my sink my teeth into. So overall, I was a bit disappointed with the story, and especially, this is the big point here, I just made a note of it before, the pacing. Act 1, introduction of the situation, the characters, takes us about 80 pages, 50, 80, 100 pages or something like, not a lot at all. Act 2, Furbin and Holsko on one journey in one direction, and Anaplion comes in an opposite journey from the other direction. Oruman and Lois, they stayed at home and have this kind of strange, like I say, this like fantasy kind of intrigue kind of world going on there. And Act 2 takes a long, long time, all the way up to about page 530. That's where the main sort of crisis happened, where we get to the next big event. There's the events that happen at the beginning, and then we sort of have the characters reacting to that and doing their thing, and then there's another big crisis near the end, or like that you'd think should be coming around about two-thirds of the way through, except it doesn't come within two-thirds of the way through. It comes about 50 pages from the end, maybe 40 pages from the end is when Act 3 really begins in the book. So 400 pages span of this book, it just feels like really, really, really much like... very much like Ian Banks was killing time. He's like in a holding pattern, you know. Important stuff is happening and there's some interesting exploration and themes and ideas and we get to see new places, but like all the important stuff that we needed for the plot could have been covered in about 100 pages, or could have been covered in, you know, he could have really picked up the pace, which means that this book, you could have literally cut 300 pages from this book, which was just set dressing. And like I say, the dressing was nothing new if you read other culture novels. And so I really felt like I was enjoying reading it. Don't get me wrong, it's fun to read because his writing style is quite enjoyable, and the characters, and they're all doing some fun stuff. But plot-wise, it's sort of like he got up to, like he said to his publishers, oh, I'm going to write a 570 page book. And he was like, oh, okay, then it's coming. So he starts writing, it's like, oh, not really sure. And he starts writing, he meanders his way through to about page 500, and then he goes, oh, I need to write an ending. And he just writes off the ending, churns it out in about 30 pages, and that's it. And the ending just hits you like a slap in the face. It just comes out of nowhere. And it just stops. And I don't mind sort of surprise endings, but this one was even more surprised, mainly because, like I said, there's the main story, and then there's a glossary, and then there's the epilogue after the glossary. So you think you're getting, you think you've still got like maybe 30, 40 pages, because I actually, like I say, when I saw these grey colour pages at the end of the book, I flicked back in front of it, and just in front of the interview with Ian and Banks there, it had like a story there. So I thought the story would end and continuously up into page 590, but I didn't realise that there was going to be like a break of 20 pages for the glossary before that. So when I'm saying the book ended like a slap in the face, it literally ended like 80 pages before I got to the back cover, and it really, really caught me out. And again, the way it ends is a bit like, oh, and it ends. Now, I don't mind really hard stops of a book at that kind of really sharp conclusion, but the rest of the book has to earn it. There has to be enough plot leading up to that, and in this book, unfortunately, the plot was like weak and drawn out up until that place, so that's why the surprise ending, while it might have been done intentionally, it certainly wasn't an enjoyable or satisfying or even that clever kind of finish to the book. And so, yeah, pacing and the length of the book, like I say, this could have been like a really, really good 300-page novel. I really do believe that, but it just wasn't there. And this is the thing that I actually like about all the other culture books, especially like I reviewed Use of Weapons, and everything in that book needed to be there because it was about a personal journey. Even though it was set in like a big space opera kind of universe, it was a personal journey, and it was like you're following, like, and everything that was there were like really contributed a lot to the personal development and the exploration of one person's, you know, mind and personality and history, and that's really good. And the reason Player of Games is one of my favourite cultural novels is because it's got its real briskness. It really hops from one scene to the next, and every step is crucial to the plot along the way and the journey of the protagonist. And of course, Player of Games is only a few hundred pages long. Whereas this book, you don't have like that real focus on a single character like you do with Use of Weapons. You don't have that sort of brisk pacing, the brisk kind of storytelling that you get with Player of Games. So yeah, really, really floppy. And then, of course, the conclusion, when it does happen, then you go to the epilogue and you work out, yeah, of course, you could sort of see the character that comes out on top, the character who gets through to the end. You know that's the character that's going to get through to the end, like, from about half the way through, because there's actually only one person in this book who is really going on some kind of personal journey. And when you read the book, you'll work out exactly who it is. And then when it happens at the end, you're just like, yep, that's good as well. Again, it's not one of the it's not a kind of thing that it spoils it or any way that it actually does happen, because it is an interesting journey that this one character goes on. But when there's sort of like another five characters that we're concentrating on quite a lot of depth, him being the main thing at the very end is like, not really sure. And finally, about the plot, the entire book seems to rely on like the coinciding of two unconnected plots. You've got the war between the different levels of Sursumon, and that's set about, in fact, by the culture. So it is sort of like culture goings on there. But then what eventually leads to this sort of big thing going on at the end of the book is this archaeological dig, which was set in place or set up not by the culture, but instead by the Oct. And the culture doesn't even know about it, and, you know, because the Oct are doing their own kind of thing, or are they? Not really quite sure what's going on, or are they being manipulated? Not really sure. So the only way that I can see that these two different threads are actually tied together in any way, more than just by a coincidence that they happen to happen in the same place at the same time, is if an outside force was sort of, it must have created a river between two inland seas, and somehow manipulated like the special contact agents without them knowing. And both of those, you know, it's possible, but a bit unlikely. So I might be missing something. Maybe there's something really key in the book which I skipped over or just didn't pick up when I read it, but I'm not really sure. So that's all about the plot, because I've been going on a half an hour, so I'm going to see if I can pick it up and get through to the end of this review a bit more quickly. The characters, all of them pretty good. Nice guys, suitably nice and enjoyable to read about. The bad guys, suitably bad, even if their motives, you know, never really explained in full, but they're there and they do their thing. There's some ships and the drones. They steal every scene that they're in, which is a common theme in the culture novels, and which might be one of the reasons why the main drone, I can't remember his name now, the main drone in this book is of course the real cool guy at the beginning. You really enjoy spending time with him, but then he's sort of taken out of the book. He's not completely taken out, but a lot of his abilities are stripped away, so he takes a much smaller role in the book than otherwise would be expected. But generally, of course, Ian M. Banks, he does a good job with his characters. So I've got really no complaints about them. Firbin and Hulse, the prince and his servant, are two of my favourites, I guess, mainly because they seem to have the hardest task. You know, they start off right at the very beginning. It's sort of like this coward prince and his lowly servant, and they have to sort of get themselves into a position where they can influence the culture in some way. And that, they realise, is a big mountain to climb. And even if they don't realise it, we as the readers do. Moving on to technology. Standard culture kind of stuff, not a lot else going on. There's some good descriptions of, like, the alien worlds, like the Morthenfeld ships are quite interesting, and the home system is quite interesting. But the thing is, we only ever meet, like, as I said before, one or two at the most of the Morthenfeld, like, alien individuals. So I could never really connect the technology with the psychology of the aliens and see how they're tied together. That's what I really like about the culture, is that the technology informs the society and the sort of, you know, rationale of the setup of the culture. And, you know, and it works both ways, you know, and then that the culture, the way that they think, also influences what kind of technology that they use. You know, it's a big thing that they will actually fight for the rights of artificial intelligence to be given sort of like a status are equal to, like, biological sentient aliens as well. So that was all. That was a bit disappointing, even though the actual technology was very interesting. I'm not going to go into it in depth, because it's one of those things that reading about it is the whole joy. It's not, if I just told you what was going on, it wouldn't be that interesting when you actually got to read of it. Finally, though, about the Shell World, I was a little bit disappointed to find out the Shell World. At one point, they suddenly go, oh, and it's got an extra dimension. It's sort of like it has structure in a fourth dimension. And it was never actually explained why, because you know, it didn't seem to make any difference to the inside of the Shell World. It wasn't like bigger on the inside than it was on the outside, like a TARDIS kind of ship. In fact, it didn't have any impact on the story at all, except that it meant that a culture ship couldn't fly inside the Shell World and function on the inside of it. And this meant, of course, that the humans had to go in back into the Shell World and work everything out by themselves and without the aid of a culture ship, which was interesting. But it seemed like a bit of a cheap trick, because they suddenly go, oh yeah, and there's a fourth dimension, which means the ships can't go inside. And I was like, oh okay. And that was about it. You know, there was nothing else that it added to the plot. It just took out one element to make the end of the book more interesting or different, or the way that Ian M. Banks wanted it to go. So next up, writing style. Like I said before, it's actually quite enjoyable. It's quite slick. It's a fun, humorous style. And this is why, even after all the bad points about the plot and the pacing and stuff that I didn't like about it, it's a real enjoyable read. Because, you know, there's nothing, I don't really know what else to say about it. You know, it's just, like I say, a pleasure to read. His description's very vivid. The dialogue flows very smoothly, and it's got quite a lot of humanity to it. But part of the books are very brutal, even though I say it's a very light read. And there's, which is to be expected with Ian M. Banks' fiction, and Ian Banks' fiction as well. But there's like this overall lightness of style that when the violence happens, it becomes, you know, the impact is even more brutal when it does happen. There was this one point right at the beginning of the book, actually, which really got to me. There's this character that dies, and you don't really know the book, and I didn't actually think I had any kind of emotional attachment to the character, because we've not actually met that character, but we see him die, and the way that he dies, it really, really affected me. I actually felt the injury that was actually inflicted on that person. I actually felt it in my own body. And then whenever that character was mentioned again and that he was dead, I felt the same thing actually inside my body, which was just really weird. It's like a very rare thing for an author to actually make me feel something physical inside my body, especially right at the beginning of the book, where, you know, you don't really understand what's going on, and it just comes, hits me out the blue, and it really, really got to me. And it doesn't really happen very often. Of course, if there's a sex scene in a book, you know, graphic sex scene, that can move me in some kind of physical way on the inside. But this was like a negative feeling, and it was quite unpleasant. And even now, thinking back to it, it sort of makes my blood run a little bit colder, sends a shiver down my spine. So that's actually some amazing sort of achievement of writing there at the beginning of the book. Unfortunately, no other event in the book hit me at that same level. But, you know, it was very interesting to read. Finally, I guess the themes of the book Another favourite part of my book, the book for me, actually, the two themes that seem to jump out at me, I wrote this down, one of them is the levels of power, you know, the non-involvement by the powerful parties or the involvement by other powerful parties, and this sort of, it's sort of dealt with at two levels, one within the court of the Saal, and the sort of power play is going on there. And then, of course, again, with the levels, like with the Morgenfeld at the top and the culture at the top, they're called the prime players or the involved. I think they're also called the optime, you know, the top guys there, and the mentoring system that goes all the way down. I said I mentioned that before, though. And the second theme, which really stuck out, was actually the title of the book, Matter. And there's a continuous questioning by various characters in the book about the nature of the cosmos. Because there's like this, you know, the cosmos could be faked. You know, we're all running on some big computer server bank somewhere, and it's all just a virtual world, you know. But it comes down to the point that, you know, they come up with arguments about how this couldn't take place, and even if it does take place, what we see now is the real world. It must be in some way, because we can get down to the very core of it. We can actually look at matter itself, and that's what's really important. You know, like, warfare is only important because it destroys and disrupts matter. Life is only important because it actually plays on matter. There's no point in solving problems in the abstract. You know, it's actually playing it out for real, which really decides the course of the galaxy. That's the idea behind it. And, you know, and even if you have like a virtual world and you try and decide things there, or if you model things in computers, where the culture is always doing this, it's like, oh yes, according to our models, this could be taking place, or according to our models, this can be taking place. But it's actually matter and the movement of matter and the matter being invested with energy and that energy be taken away. That's the kind of thing that counts. And of course, the attitudes of the characters in the book to this fact and the reaction to it is actually quite amusing, because it's not tied in exactly with that theme, but another theme is like the shell world is an artificial construct, and the people who live inside that, who've grown up there, they sort of discuss how, like, volcanoes, it's sort of like, ah, volcanoes, that sounds impossible, you're pulling my leg, volcanoes don't really exist, they sound like a huge waste of energy. You know, if you want to create hills, there's better ways of creating hills, and if you want to create seas, there's better ways of creating seas, and it's that whole kind of thing, you know, that they're looking at a sun and they're going, wow, that's really inefficient. Why have a huge sun millions of miles away when you can have lots of smaller suns sort of rolling around on the top of the ceiling or just inside the ceiling above your head? That's what you really need. And you know, it's sort of like, yeah, and astrology, you know, astrology with suns, you know, and that kind of thing. Of course they affect your lives, because there's suns going past on the roof above your head, but also underneath the ground below your feet, there's other suns going past. Of course, everything is fake. Everything's been designed. Everything's been constructed. So they have no, like, worries about believing that they themselves have been designed. You know, there's a god. Of course, one lives in the basement. There's actually a god in the center of the world. Of course, it's not a god. It's like a massively advanced alien. But the alien has just as much impact on their own world as a super spiritual god, like an actual theistic god, would have on the galaxy. So they're going, well, our world is designed, why can't the cosmos be designed? So there's a whole kind of intelligent design idea being discussed here as well, and you know, to species who live in, how would I say, like in a massively engineered galactic environment, intelligent design is, of course, the most obvious conclusion to reach. So that's another interesting theme that was explored. So maybe three themes there that I really liked. So last bit of my comments here that I wrote down. This book would actually be quite a good introduction to the culture, but it's not as good as other culture books. The interview at the end is actually quite interesting. You get a few pages of Ian M. Banks talking in his own voice. The thing is, the answers that he gives about the culture are just as well answered by his fiction itself. His fiction is actually good enough to speak for its own. You know, it's such a strong vision that he doesn't actually need to talk about these, like the culture itself. But he does talk about his writing, and he said that he had actually felt he had sort of run out of ideas a bit, that's what he felt like it. So, you know, because it was like he was kept on going back to the same ideas. So he took a break for a while, and then he wrote The Algebrist, which was his last science fiction book, which it wasn't said in the culture. And it's like, yeah, and now I've got all these new ideas, and I really feel like I've got a lot more to say about science fiction. The thing is that it does actually seem like he has still run out of ideas. Not completely run out of ideas, but for such a big book, I think I needed more ideas, more new ideas. It was too much of a rehashing of his old stuff. A quick note about The Algebrist, though, because I won't be reviewing that. in this or anytime soon, not in the next few years, because I did read it. I guess I just read it last year or the year before, and it was a fun book. It's a good book, but again, it's sort of like this book. There's stuff going on, and there's lots of, they go on a journey, and you sort of see lots of interesting kind of stuff. But the actual plot, the thing that's driving the plot and the key to it, the mystery behind it, is actually given away in the prologue before the story even begins. So that all the time this character's going around and going sort of like, oh, what's going to happen? Oh, I need to find out this thing. Oh, there's this big mystery. And all the way through, you're going, just read it. Just read the thing there. Just switch on your brain. You'll work it all out. The answer is right in front of you all this time. And it's a good fun book, but it's like that sort of, when they get to the ending, it's sort of like the unsatisfying ending when you finally get there, even though the journey is worth it. So this is a solid like 3.5 star book, The Algebraist. So definitely read it. It's worth it to pick it up and read it. But Matter is, like I say, it's like the same kind of thing, but instead of being new ideas like The Algebraist, it's like a remix of previous material and ideas combined with sort of like I say this workmanlike fantasy kind of elements. And you know, when I say fantasy, there's battles on the backs of flying creatures. You know, that's what kind of warfare we've got going on there. But this book, you know, like I say, because it's sort of rehashing old ideas and the plot. You know, I talked 25 minutes about the plotting of the book. It just wasn't there, but there is a lot of good stuff about it. Let down, I guess, in the end by the atrocious pacing and things, and the end that literally felt like a slap in the face. Like I said, it's just like, end. I'm like, what? Yeah, you cut. So, this book, I'm going to give 3 stars, which means it's, I guess, I'd call it one of Ian M. Banks' weakest science fiction novels. But, you know, it's like, if your weakest novel is a 3-star book, that's pretty good. But check it out. 3 stars mean you should be picking it up secondhand, or if you're a fan of Ian M. Banks, like I am, just you know, pick it up and read it. But don't read it don't pick it up as a hardback, and don't pay too much money for it. But just get it and read it. But if you're new to the culture, check out other culture books first. I would recommend those other two that I mentioned. No, those are the two. Yeah, Consider Phlebas and Player of Games are the two best introductions into the culture. So there you go, 3 stars, no, not bad at all. Next book that I'm going to be reviewing is one of the most recommended books that I get in all the emails that get sent through, and one of the most requested reviews, and that is Dan Simmons' book Hyperion. So I haven't started it yet. I've taken a few days off from reading science fiction until I got caught up with the reviews again. But there you go. Hyperion coming up. Email me at luke@juggler.net if you've got any feedback, or if you want to defend Matt, or if you want to say anything else about the book that I've been reviewing today, or if you've got any other book suggestions or anything else that you want to ask me, just send it through. luke@juggler.net is my email. So, hope you enjoyed today's review, and I'll catch you next time.